శ్రీ కృష్ణ ప్రేమ్స్ 1948 విజిట్ టు శ్రీ రమణ మహర్షి బై ఎస్ చక్రవర్తి టోబు. మెనీ హ్యావ్ రెడ్ దిలీప్ కుమార్ రాయ్స్ డిస్క్రిప్షన్ ఆఫ్ శ్రీ కృష్ణ ప్రేమ్స్ విజిట్ టు ద మహర్షి. ద ఫాలోయింగ్ నరేషన్ అపియర్స్ టు బి అ ఫార్ మోర్ డీటెయిల్డ్ అండ్ క్రెడిబుల్ అకౌంట్ దాన్ ఎనీ ఆఫ్ ది అదర్స్ ప్రీవియస్లీ పబ్లిష్డ్. ఇట్ వాజ్ రిటన్ బై ది బెంగాలీ డివోటీ హూ అరేంజ్డ్ Krishna Prem's South Indian pilgrimage and enumerates the many ways in which Bhagavan singled out Sri Krishna Prem to extend his grace. While engaging, the author presents us with genuine insight into the intriguing personality and devotional character of a Western devotee who embraced orthodox Vaishnavism and yet by the intensity of his devotion was enabled to experience the essence of Bhagavan's true nature. In 1948, when I was staying at Ramanashramam, I got a letter from Gopal Da, Sri Krishna Prem. He wrote to say that all his previous plans to come south went wrong for one reason or another. Now that I was staying at Tiruvannamalai, Gopal Da said that he would like to come for Ramana Maharishi's darshan and then would proceed to Pondicherry for Sri Aurobindo's darshan. From there, he intended to visit a few other pilgrim spots. He mentioned the date of his arrival at Madras and asked me to meet him at the station. I was then occupying a couple of outhouses with thatched roofs attached to the Pakka building of Dr. Syed. As Dr. Syed was then away and the keys of the house were left with Miss Murston, I contacted her and kept one room ready for Gopal Das' sojourn. I said nothing about Gopal Das' intended visit to anyone. The only person who knew was, of course, Miss Murston. The evening I left for Madras, I made my obeisance to the Maharishi, just after the evening chanting of passages from the Vedas and Upanishads, and begged his permission to leave for Madras. I would repeat that I gave no reason for my intended visit to Madras, no, not even to the Maharishi. As usual, the Maharishi nodded and said, "Sari po, all right, go." I was waiting on the platform for the main train to arrive from Calcutta on the scheduled day. In due course, Gopal Da alighted from his compartment and was joined by one Upadhyaya who was then attached to the Rice Research Center in Orissa and had boarded the train at Cuttack. He accompanied Gopal Da to Ramanashramam and was with us during Gopal Da's trip to South India. At this point, Tapo Gopal Mukherjee, Postmaster General of Madras, came to meet Gopal Da. He was the son of Pran Gopal Mukherjee, elder brother of Govinda Gopal, the cousin of Mohananda Brahmachari. He was to have been Gopal Da's host at Madras, but he said he was staying in a hotel because no quarters were yet available to him. Of course, he said he had reserved accommodation in the hotel, but Gopal Da told him he could not possibly stay in a hotel. An impasse ensued. Gopal Da turned to me and asked if I knew anyone in Madras with whom he could stay for a day or two. It so happened that I knew no one in Madras. However, there was one exception. When I used to meet Mantu Mama, Dilip Kumar Roy of Pondicherry in Madras, we would put up with the Guptas. Mr. Gupta then being the income tax commissioner. But they had left Madras. There was yet another Bengali couple whom Dilip would visit whenever he was in Madras. I thought of this couple, but there was a big snag. The couple were not married, and the lady, Nehar Bala, used to be on the stage. However, They were attached to Aurobindo Ashram. I took Gopalda aside and informed him about this arrangement. When he heard that they were devotees of Sri Aurobindo, Gopalda did not hesitate and asked me to take him to their house. So we left for the residence in Tapu Gopal's station wagon. When we got there, I asked Gopalda and others to wait while I went to see the lay of the land, for I confess that I was feeling rather uncomfortable. When I came to the house, I found Nihadbala impatiently walking up and down the veranda. And the moment she saw me, she asked if the Mahatma had come. It was my turn to be surprised. She explained that they had got the news of Gopal Das coming from Dilip and that Mr. Ghosh, I hope I have got the name right, had gone to the station to meet Mahatma and to bring him there. When I told her that Gopal Das was waiting at the gate, she ran past me and prostrated herself in the dust at the gate. So all appeared to be going well, and I heaved a sigh of relief. Nihadbala showed Gopalda the bedroom and explained that everything, the pillowcases, the bed sheets, was brand new. She further told us that she had had the room scrubbed and washed with Ganges water, obviously brought from Calcutta. When I asked her why she went to the trouble of doing all this when Gopalda was not meant to come there, she said she had been praying to Sri Aurobindo from the moment she got Dilip's letter that the Mahatma, namely Gopalda, might be directed to come and stay there. By then, Mr. Ghosh rushed back from the station and was overjoyed to find Gopalda actually staying with them. He explained that he missed us at the station because the train had arrived before time. So far, all is well that ends well. But another snag was about food. Gopalda told us he could take food only if it was cooked by a Brahmin or a Vaishnava. Otherwise, rice and dal were forbidden. Gopalda then turned to me and ordered me to go and have my bath and then to cook the food. I vehemently protested and told him I had never cooked before. However, our hostess assured me that I had no reason to worry. She would do all the preliminary chores, and all I would be called on to do was to put the rice, vegetables, etc. into the egg-make cooker bought especially for such an eventuality and to take them out when cooked. But the real trouble was yet to come. One has to cook the boiled dal and to put in the furong or sambarak. Our hostess put the karahi cooking dish onto the fire, and then I had to pour a little oil or something in the pan and then add the masala, spices, and then the dal. Believe me, I was fuming with rage. While going through this ordeal, Gopalda and the others were enjoying dulce fa nayanti, the most unkindest cut of all. Shakespeare's double superlative was Gopalda's verdict. He remarked that I was not such a bad cook after all. Should I ever need a job in the future, I could easily apply for. It was a great fun indeed. I narrate this incident in detail as it shows what a fine sense of humor Gopalda possessed. I would like to digress here a little and give another such example of many instances. When I first met Gopalda at Mettola, I kept using the word sir whenever I spoke to him. Soon afterwards, Gopalda took his pipe out of his mouth and said in a solemn voice, "If you go on serving me, I shall start madaming you." Or words to that effect. I give the instances intentionally because I shall connect them with a later episode. We stayed a couple of days at Madras where, among other places, Gopalda visited the Theosophical Society's center at Adyar. Being taken there and back by Tapu Gopal Babu Ramanashramam, the day soon came for our trip to Thiruvannamalai. Mr. Ghosh insisted on getting the three tickets for us, namely Gopalda, Upadhyaya and myself. We duly arrived late one evening at Thiruvannamalai station and took a jatka, a type of bullock cart drawn by a horse, to Ramanashramam. Immediately on getting down from the train, I noticed a total unexpected change in Gopalda. He looked grave and solemn and even appeared reluctant to reply to my questions. He just said yes and no, or just shook his head. When we reached our destination, it was quite dark. Gopalda dumped his two bundles and asked to be taken to the Maharishi. In one bag, he was carrying his Radha Krishna murtis in a wooden box, which he later told the Maharishi he himself had made. In the second bag was his wearing apparel, the sadhu's ochre colored dhoti, etc. I have to say I was feeling unhappy on account of his seeming taciturnity and was wondering whether I had done something to bring it about. I consulted Upadhyaya, who said he had never known Chautaba, little father, the form of address used by Mutirani, to be so silent. He too kept wondering at the change. We three started off to the ashram, which was only a few minutes walking distance away. Instead of taking the main approach by the side of the office room, I took this straight alleyway which passes between the office room and the dining hall. From where the Maharishi sat in the veranda, one could immediately see anyone who stepped into this alley. I should also explain that the Maharishi hardly ever looked at those who gathered round him. Most often he would just be sitting there, merged in trance, or alternatively sat looking at what? Space, the hill, the sky, or nothing? But the moment Gopalda stepped into the alley, Ramana turned fully and kept staring with those sparkling eyes of his at Gopalda. We went up to his seat and I bowed down with my forehead touching the ground. Then I looked up and started to tell him about Gopalda, who was lying prostrate before his seat. But the Maharishi stopped me short by waving his Angavastra or Angabharan, a cloth commonly worn over the shoulder in South India, impatiently, and invited Gopalda to sit near the stone couch on which he was sitting. Here I must explain that no one was allowed to sit so close to the Maharishi. I also got the impression from the Maharishi's behavior that he already knew Gopalda, so that a formal introduction was not necessary. Then Ramana sent someone to call Sadhu Arunachala, Major Chadwick, who had been staying at the ashram for many years. He also directed those in charge of the dining hall to prepare something without chili for Gopalda and also to arrange for milk. For the few days Gopalda stayed at the ashram, he was always given the first seat at meals, just in front of the Maharishi's seat, so that the Maharishi could see and give necessary instructions about the food prepared for and served to Gopalda. At this time, Gopalda sat with his head bowed. His face appeared to me to be extraordinarily red or flushed. Then I witnessed a peculiar incident. Gopalda suddenly jerked his head up and looked at the Maharishi, who was seemingly unconcerned. Again, Gopalda bowed his head. Then the Maharishi asked me what arrangements I had made for Gopalda's stay, and he then indicated that as supper time was drawing near, Gopalda might like to go back and have his bath. We got up, and then Gopalda exchanged a few words with Chadwick near the well, and we walked back to Dr. Syed's place. Gopalda fell silent again and seemed to be in a sort of deep thought. I left instructions that the bath should be filled with water, but Gopalda refused to bathe in that water and asked me to draw fresh water from the well. He had a hurried bath and lit an agarbatti incense stick before the images of Radha Krishna, and then we trooped back to the ashram for supper. When we came to the dining hall, we found the Maharishi waiting there for Gopalda. We had supper and returned to our place. Gopalda was deep in thought and kept pacing the veranda in silence. After a little while, I summoned up enough courage to mutter about preparing his bed. He stopped for a moment and said that we need not bother about him, that he would go to bed when he felt sleepy, and that we should retire. I was utterly bewildered and knew not what to think of his completely changed behavior. Upadhyaya and I waited a little longer. Gopalda was still walking up and down the veranda. Then Upadhyaya spread his blanket on the floor, and I went back to my room, which was just behind the one intended for Gopalda's use. I whispered to Upadhyaya that he should call me if necessary. I just did not know what I could or should do. I had a very disturbed night and was up at the crack of dawn to reconnoiter. I found that Gopalda was also up. I asked Upadhyaya if Gopalda had gone to bed last night, but he could not say, as he had gone to sleep. We drew fresh water from the well and Gopalda had his bath. Then he got ready to do his puja. I found that he was carrying water from the Ganga, a stick of sandalwood, tulasi leaves, incense sticks, and oil and wicks for a lamp. He suddenly turned to me and asked if I could not get some fresh flowers. Though I knew there was a garden attached to the ashram, I doubted that an outsider like me would be allowed to pick flowers, but I could try. Just as I stepped out of the room, I found Raja, the ashram postmaster, with something in his hand. I called Gopalda, and Raja handed him a small packet of fresh flowers in a plantain leaf. Raja said that the Maharishi personally directed the picking of the flowers and sent them by him. For the first time since his arrival at Tiruvannamalai station, Gopalda's face lost that strained, stern look. It was beaming with a smile. In a choked voice, he said, "Indeed, the Maharishi is Bhagavan. He knew what my heart yearned for." I must explain that the ashramites and devotees habitually refer to the Maharishi as Bhagavan. In North India, this word is used in the sense of God, but in the South, it is a term of respect. I too heaved a sigh of relief. As we arrived for breakfast, we found the Maharishi was again waiting for Gopalda. Words failed me, and I just don't know how best to convey what lies deep in my heart. As a matter of fact, this sort of loving and affectionate respect was bestowed on Gopalda by the Maharishi on each and every occasion. The Maharishi also arranged for Gopalda to be taken round to see the caves and other places where he had stayed before the ashram was built. Then he was taken to have the darshan of the lingam in the main temple, but the Purohit did not allow him to enter the sanctum sanctorum on the pretext that he was a Yavan, a foreigner. I was amazed at Gopal Das's reaction. He was not at all upset or angry. On the contrary, he endorsed the Purohit's action. What he said was something like this: how can a Purohit be expected to know the true character and purpose of a foreigner? Most foreigners indulge in casting aspersions and ridicule and the like. However, he was shown the Patala Lingam, the small enclosure where the Maharishi had spent many days merged in trance, oblivious to the outside world. As he sat there, cross-legged for days and weeks, the backs of his thighs had been eaten away by worms. This was the time for annual festival called Kartikeya Deepam. Crowds of pilgrims had gathered to attend the festival and to have the Maharishi's darshan. When Gopalda returned from the excursion to the temple, we found a huge crowd of pilgrims sitting in the veranda, engrossed in listening to the Maharishi. This in itself was a strange event, for, as I have said, the Maharishi hardly ever spoke to or looked at anyone. Our surprise became boundless when we found everyone looking at Gopalda and smiling and bowing. Later, we were told that, breaking from his usual habit, the Maharishi had been narrating at length the story of Sri Krishna's sojourn in Madura, and when he came to relate the eventual return of Sri Krishna to Vrindavan, it coincided with Gopal Das' return from the outing. This prompted the Maharishi to say something like this: "Ah, there you are. Have I not been telling you about Sri Krishna's return from Madura? See, here returns our Sri Krishna Prema."